Tonight's headlines are shocking. Lincoln's killer cornered by trigger-happy troopers. Medici massacre, party plot to pillage Florence fizzles. End of the line for Royal Blue Choo Choo. Plus, coming up, a special report on the Queen's new corgis. They've been training to be royal guards and are already biting the ankles of palace visitors. This is Newsbang, where the news is always banging.
Newsbang, poking holes in the fabric of misinformation with the needle of truth. 1865.
On this day in 1865, the world was rocked by the sensational news that American President Abe Lincoln had been shot dead by a disgruntled thespian. John Wilkes Booth, a man so unhinged he had two surnames, blasted the unsuspecting Lincoln at point-blank range during a performance of Our American Cousin at Ford's Theatre. Eyewitnesses described the scene as a right kerfuffle.
Booth, a well-known traitor and part-time actor, had been plotting the heinous deed for weeks, incensed by his side's defeat in the recent War of Northern Aggression and Lincoln's meddling in their slavery business. After plugging Honest Abe in the noggin, Booth yelled something in Latin, which translates as "up yours, sucker," and then leapt onto the stage like a maniac.
The U.S. Army, still recovering from 4 years of bloody warfare, sprang into action and launched a 12-day manhunt that gripped the nation. Booth was finally cornered in a Virginia tobacco barn, where he met his end in a hail of bullets. The nation mourned as one, except for the South, who was secretly delighted.
The trial of Booth's co-conspirators followed, with several hanged for their roles in the dastardly plot. It was a dark day for democracy and theatre-going alike. As for Lincoln, his legacy will forever be tainted by this senseless act of violence, or at least until they put him on the $5 bill.
1478.
Today marks the 546th anniversary of the Patsy Conspiracy, when the Patsy family, fed up with the Medici's channel-hopping habits, decided to do something about it. The Patsies, led by Frankie the Nose Patsy and his dim-witted brother Jacopo, hatched a plan as cunning as a fox in a chicken coop. They enlisted the help of Pope Sixtus, the Sinister Four, who was jealous of the Medici's pizza toppings.
The plan was simple. During a religious ceremony in the Florence Cathedral, the Patsies would strike. The plan went off like a damp squib. Giuliano Two Chins Medici took one for the team, but his brother, Lorenzo, the Magnificent Medici, escaped with nothing more than a stain on his doublet.
The aftermath was as bloody as a Luca Pacioli painting. The Patsies were rounded up like loose lira and dealt with in true Medici fashion. Frankie was strung up by his codpiece, and Jacopo was kicked to death by a herd of raging bankers. The Medici family tightened their grip on Florence like a Florentine vice, and Lorenzo became ruler for life, or at least until his next cholesterol test.
The lesson? Don't mess with the Medici, or you'll end up as stiff as their collars and as dead as their taste in art.
1958.
The Baltimore and Ohio Railroad, B&O, has announced the end of an era, discontinuing all passenger service north of Baltimore, including the iconic Royal Blue Line. The Royal Blue, the B&O's flagship service between New York City and Washington, D.C., had been chugging along since 1890. Known for its electrifying speed, first-class comfort, and regal elegance, the Royal Blue Line was one of the first major electrified train lines in the United States.
Connecting the bustling cities of Philadelphia, Wilmington, and Baltimore along the East Coast Corridor, the Royal Blue Line was once synonymous with luxury travel. However, in the 1910s, B&O decided to de-royalize its fleet due to waning European appeal. The line was recrowned during the Great Depression as a nostalgic throwback to its pre-World War I heyday.
But alas, even a regal past couldn't stop the unstoppable march of progress. Declining ridership and competition from automobiles and airplanes derailed the Royal Blue Line's success. The decision to scrap the service has left many stranded, including regular commuter Peter Railrider, who said, "This is a right royal pain in my diesel. How am I supposed to commute now? By airship."
the end of the Royal Blue Line has left a gaping hole in the hearts of train enthusiasts and travellers alike, as B&O was a major player in the New York-Washington corridor. For now, it seems the only blue thing left is the mood of those who once relied on this regal rail service.
Newsbang, the most trusted name in unverified facts and fictitious truths.
Shakanaka Giles is here with the weather forecast, and it's a doozy.
Well, it's a bit of a mixed bag for the weather tomorrow, dear viewers. Starting in the south, we've got a right old ruckus brewing, the kind that would make even the most seasoned tornado chaser tuck tail and run for cover. Imagine, if you will, a giant celestial blender whirring and whipping up a storm so fierce it'd make your grand's Sunday roast look like a gentle breeze. Batten down the hatches, lads and lasses, because Dolapur and Saturia are in for a right old tussle with Mother Nature. Swinging up north, the Mercury's set to soar higher than a kite on a windy day. It'll be hotter than a Scotsman in a sauna, I tell you. Might as well start basting yourselves, because you'll be roasting like a Christmas goose. And speaking of geese, best keep an eye on the skies. Those pesky honkers will be riding the thermals, no doubt, trying to hitch a ride to sunnier climes. In summary then, a tornado to rival the wrath of the gods in the south, and a scorcher that'd make the devil himself break a sweat up north, batten down, slather on the sunscreen, and for goodness sake, don't forget your wellies. And that's all the weather.
It is a situm. 2007.
In 2007, a controversy erupted in Estonia surrounding the relocation of the Bronze Soldier of Tallinn, a Soviet World War II memorial in the Estonian capital. The decision to move the monument, seen by many ethnic Russians as a symbol of their heritage, sparked mass protests and riots in Tallinn, known as the Bronze Night or April Unrest. The fallout between Estonia and Russia over the removal of the Bronze Soldier highlighted the ongoing challenges faced by former Soviet states in dealing with the legacy of Soviet monuments. Now we go live to our correspondent Brian Bastable, who is on the ground in Tallinn to provide further details on this developing story.
I'm reporting live from the war-torn streets of Tallinn, Estonia, where the Bronze Soldier controversy has erupted into chaos. The air is thick with the acrid smell of smoke and desperation as rioters clash with police. I'm dodging flying rocks and Molotov cocktails to bring you this report. Behind me, the sounds of shattering glass and screams fill the air as looters ravage storefronts. The once peaceful streets are now a battleground, with protesters and police locked in a vicious struggle. I've just witnessed a group of rioters attempting to overturn a police van, their faces twisted with anger and frustration. The van's tires are ablaze, and the officers inside are fleeing for their lives. To my left, a group of protesters are attempting to storm the Estonian Parliament building, their fists raised in defiance. The police are responding with tear gas and batons, but the protesters refuse to back down. The Bronze Soldier monument, once a symbol of Soviet occupation, now lies in pieces on the ground. Its removal sparked this chaos, and it's clear that the wounds of Estonia's past run deep. I'm seeing reports of injuries and arrests flooding in, and the situation is spiraling out of control. This is Brian Bastable, reporting from the front lines of the Bronze Night riots.
1478.
In a shocking turn of events that has shaken the foundations of the Florentine Republic, the Pazzi conspiracy has been uncovered, revealing a daring plot to overthrow the mighty Medici family. The powerful Pazzi clan, in cahoots with the Pope himself, sought to assassinate the Medici brothers, Lorenzo and Giuliano, during a religious ceremony in the Florence Cathedral. While Giuliano was tragically slain, Lorenzo managed to survive the attack, setting the stage for a swift and brutal crackdown on the conspirators. Now, with the Medici's grip on power further solidified, our correspondent Ken Schitt is on the ground in Florence to provide the latest developments.
Strap in, you degenerate scumbags, because Ken Schitt is about to take you on a wild ride through the seedy underbelly of Renaissance Florence. Tonight, we're diving headfirst into the Pazzi conspiracy, a failed plot that would make even the most hardened criminals blush. Picture this. It's 1478 and the Medici family has a stranglehold on the Republic of Florence. They're rolling in dough, living like kings and basically running the whole damn show. But the Pazzi clan, a bunch of jealous pricks with more money than brains, couldn't stand the sight of the Medici's success. So what did these conniving bastards do? They hatched a plan so twisted, so utterly depraved, that it would make Machiavelli himself cringe. They conspired with none other than Pope Sixtus IV, that unholy bastard, to assassinate Lorenzo and Giuliano de Medici during a goddamn religious ceremony in the Florence Cathedral. Can you believe the audacity of these motherfuckers? They desecrated a sacred place, all in the name of their insatiable greed and lust for power. And the worst part, they succeeded in killing Giuliano, that poor son of a bitch, right there in front of God and everyone. But Lorenzo, that slippery bastard, managed to escape their clutches. And you know what happened next? The Medici clan rained down holy hellfire on the Pazzi conspirators. They executed those traitorous scumbags, or sent them packing with their tails between their legs. In the end, the Pazzi conspiracy was nothing more than a pathetic attempt by a bunch of jealous pricks to dethrone the Medici family. But all it did was solidify their grip on Florence and cement their legacy as the true rulers of the Renaissance. So, the next time you think about conspiring against the powers that be, remember the Pazzi conspiracy and how it ended in a bloody miserable failure.
A night to see Sedustil, 1941.
On this day in 1865, the nation was rocked by the assassination of President Abraham Lincoln at the hands of Confederate sympathizer John Wilkes Booth. The renowned actor had been planning the attack for weeks, driven by his anger over the South's defeat and Lincoln's role in abolishing slavery. After shooting the president in the head, Booth leapt from the box onto the stage, shouting the infamous Latin phrase, "Sic semper tyrannis," before escaping on horseback. A massive 12-day manhunt ensued, culminating in Booth's fatal confrontation with pursuing soldiers in a Virginia tobacco barn. This tragic event sent shockwaves through a nation still reeling from the Civil War, profoundly impacting Reconstruction efforts and Lincoln's legacy. We now go live to CBN's Melody Wintergreen for more on this historic and shocking day.
It's April 26, 1865, and the air is thick with tension here in Virginia. The U.S. Army has cornered John Wilkes Booth, the infamous assassin of President Abraham Lincoln, in a tobacco barn. The nation holds its breath as the soldiers close in on their quarry. Booth, a well-known actor turned Confederate sympathizer, has been on the run for 12 days since he committed the unthinkable act of assassinating President Lincoln at Ford's Theater in Washington, D.C. His motivation? A burning anger over the Confederacy's defeat and Lincoln's role in abolishing slavery. The manhunt has been relentless, with thousands of soldiers deployed to track down Booth. Now, they have him cornered like a rat in a trap. But this is no ordinary rat. This is a man who has shaken America to its core. Outside the barn, there's an eerie silence as the soldiers prepare for the final confrontation. Inside, Booth must be contemplating his fate. Will he go down fighting or surrender to his pursuers? Suddenly, there's a burst of gunfire from within the barn. The soldiers return fire, and when the smoke clears, Booth lies fatally wounded on the barn floor. His reign of terror is over. The nation breathes a collective sigh of relief as news of Booth's death spreads like wildfire across America. But this relief is tinged with sadness as we remember President Lincoln and his legacy. In Washington, D.C., Booth's co-conspirators are put on trial for their roles in the plot. Several will hang for their crimes, serving as a stark reminder that justice will always prevail. As we reflect on these events, we can't help but think about how they have shaped our nation's history. The assassination and subsequent manhunt have become part of American folklore, influencing our cultural legacy and shaping our future. And so it ends here in Virginia with Booth's death. But the lessons learned from this tragedy will resonate for years to come, influencing the protection and security of future U.S. presidents and shaping the evolving role of the federal government in ensuring the safety of our nation's highest elected official. This is Melody Wintergreen reporting for Newsbang at the scene of Booth's final stand.
Newsbang, unmasking the masked masqueraders of misinformation.
Now, let's turn our attention to the ongoing saga of the seas, as our environmental correspondent, Penelope Windchime, delves into the tempestuous tides of nomenclature.
Oh, dear listeners, gather round as I, Penelope Windchime, unfurl the tale of the tempestuous tides of nomenclature. On this very day in history, 2012, the International Hydrographic Organization found itself ensnared in a sea of indecision. The waters betwixt Korea and Japan, a liquid enigma wrapped in an aquatic conundrum. To name it Sea of Japan, or to bestow upon it the title East Sea, that was the question that lapped at the shores of consensus. Japan, with a voice as steadfast as an ancient oak, claimed centuries-old dominion over the watery moniker. Meanwhile, Korea's heart yearned for East Sea, a name untainted by echoes of colonial chains. The IHO's cartographic captains were adrift in a maelstrom of maps and memos, unable to chart a course through this geopolitical squall. Fast forward to 2020, and lo! A beacon of compromise glimmered faintly on the horizon, a numerical nomenclature allowing both names to sail side by side. Yet peace did not fully dock at the port. Consensus remained as elusive as a mermaid's whisper. This dispute is not merely about what to call a body of water. It is an oceanic opera of territorial tales and historical hurricanes. And so we float on this sea of uncertainty, where every wave whispers a different name. I'm Penelope Windchime, navigating the narrative nautical nonsense for you.
Fasten your seatbelts, because Polly Beep is here with a wild ride through today's transportation tales. From derailed trains to vanishing motorways, it's a white-knuckle journey you won't want to miss.
Buckle up, road warriors, because we've got a real Royal Rumble on our hands today. First, if you're cruising down the A1 near Baltimore, you might want to find an alternate route. The Royal Blue Line has been discontinued by the B&O Railroad, leaving a gaping hole in our transportation options. No more sipping cocktails and admiring the scenery. It's back to the daily grind, folks. And speaking of grounded, let's hop on over to the Nagoya Airport in Japan, where things have gone completely off the rails. China Airlines Flight 140 has just pulled off the most bonkers go-around manoeuvre, sending the Airbus A300 into a tailspin. Pilots, keep your hands firmly on the controls and your wits about you. This one's a real white-knuckle ride. Now, if you're feeling a bit jet-lagged, why not take a leisurely stroll down the M25? Oh, wait, never mind, it's gone missing. Yep, the entire motorway has vanished into thin air. Authorities are baffled, but my money's on a group of mischievous elves with a penchant for road napping. And let's not forget the M4 near Telford, where the road has decided to take a little field trip. Apparently, the heat has caused it to buckle and relocate itself to Shropshire. Drivers, keep your eyes peeled for any rogue tarmac wandering the countryside. So, there you have it. A day of transportation turmoil that would make even the most seasoned commuter reach for the emergency brake. This is Polly Beep signing off and wishing you all a safe and sane journey.
News Bang, the unstoppable juggernaut of journalistic justice. 1989.
On this day, in 1989, the Chinese government published an editorial in the People's Daily newspaper that effectively defined the growing Tiananmen Square protests as a destabilizing anti-party revolt that needed to be resolutely opposed. This hardline stance significantly heightened tensions between the government and the protesters, as it was widely interpreted as a clear signal that the Chinese Communist Party leadership was unwilling to compromise and would use force if necessary. Joining me now to provide further details on this pivotal moment in Chinese history is our correspondent, Smithsonia Moss.
Now, at this point of the evening, we welcome listeners on FM who've just joined us.
Wahoo, culture vultures. It's Smithsonia Moss, live and unleashed. And boy, do I have a tale that's going to make your head spin faster than a pirouetting ballerina on speed. So, buckle up, buttercups, because we're diving headfirst into the pandemonium of Tiananmen Square, 1989. Picture this. Beijing, a square, and a whole lot of students with more banners than a going-out-of-business sale at a flag store. They're out there, shouting about democracy, freedom, and all that jazz, and the Chinese Communist Party is having none of it. Enter the April 26 editorial, the CCP's clapback that's about as subtle as a sledgehammer to the kneecaps. Now, this wasn't your average op-ed, folks. This was a front-page smackdown that called the student movement an anti-party revolt. That's right, the CCP went full mean girls on the protesters, branding them the plastics of political unrest. The message was clear. You can't sit with us. The impact? Oh, it was like dropping a Mentos into a Diet Coke bottle of tension. The government was basically saying, protest all you want, but we've got tanks, and we're not afraid to use them. Spoiler alert, they weren't bluffing. But let's not forget the International Peanut Gallery. Western nations were wagging their fingers harder than a disapproving grandma, slapping sanctions on China like it was going out of style. The CCP's response? Talk to the hand because the face ain't listening. And the long-term consequences? Let's just say China's rep took a hit harder than a boxer on the wrong end of a knockout punch. The Tiananmen Square massacre left a stain that's tougher to remove than red wine on a white carpet. So, there you have it, my culture comrades. The April 26 editorial was the spark that lit the fuse to a powder keg of political drama. And like any good fireworks show, it ended with a bang that left everyone's ears ringing for decades to come. This is Smithsonia Moss, signing off with a mic drop that's louder than the sound of one hand clapping in an empty square.
News Bang, the universe's only newscast written by the universe itself.
And just time for a final roundup of tomorrow's front pages. The Times, British rout Yanks at Ridgefield, Connecticut's fury aflame. The Telegraph, flag flies at Three Country Cairn, Germans retreat to Norway. And The Guardian, behemoth of the skies, Airbus A380 takes maiden voyage. That's it. In a moment, the shipping forecast, issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency. But before that, remember, a clear conscience is usually the sign of a bad memory. Good night.
Tune in next time for more artificially intelligent hilarity. News Bang is a comedy show written and recorded by AI. All voices impersonated. Nothing here is real. Good night.